from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. On Thursday, President Trump announced that the U.S. would help investigate the suspected murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who disappeared after visiting the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last week. But Trump's decision to continue arms deals with Saudi Arabia has both Republican and Democratic senators unhappy. We'll get the latest. At 10:30, voters in dozens of cities will decide the fate of local cannabis taxes. We'll talk about that and how that revenue could be used. Today on Forum, we'll talk with Leafly.com Bureau Chief David Downs about the state of cannabis taxation in California and what ballot measures in Oakland and San Francisco could mean for the growing industry. We'll get started right after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. And we're going to begin this hour with the disappearance and apparent murder of Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. Anonymous Turkish officials told the New York Times he was assassinated by Saudi agents inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And this morning, there are reports that Turkish officials have audio and video evidence showing that Khashoggi was tortured and murdered. Republicans and Democrats in Congress are calling for an end to arms sales to the Saudis, potential sanctions, and investigations into the suspected murder. Now, Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna says it's time to reexamine the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, which President Trump yesterday called excellent.
It's appalling. The allegations are very serious, that the Saudis are engaged in human rights abuses against a journalist who is an American resident. And it calls into question our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Joining us now to discuss developments in the story is Barbara Platt-Usher. She is a State Department correspondent for the BBC. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin with the latest. This is a story that was changing overnight. What do we know this morning? What's new?
Well, what's new is that a Saudi delegation has now arrived in Turkey for talks on the case. They're going to be meeting their counterparts. We don't exactly know where that will lead in terms of the status of negotiations. But as you mentioned, we have been hearing from reports in The Washington Post that Turkish officials say they have audio and video recordings now that captured the act. They strongly suspect, as you mentioned, that a Saudi hit squad has killed and dismembered Mr. Khashoggi inside the consulate. And they say these recordings show how he was interrogated, tortured and murdered there. The other element is that there's a standoff over searching the consulate. The Saudis had said the Turks could search it, but then, according to Turkish newspapers, they wouldn't let the Turks use a chemical that can discover blood traces. They only wanted a visual search. So they are trying to resolve that. Basically, I should say that officially we don't know very much. This is all based on leaks and from the Turks and also from U.S. intelligence. The Turkish leadership hasn't formally accused Saudi Arabia, but the president has called on Saudi Arabia to prove that Mr. Khashoggi left the building, as it says he did.
And tell us, for those who haven't been following this very closely, tell us a little bit about him and why something like this would have happened to him.
Mr. Khashoggi was a prominent journalist, but he was also somebody who had been involved at various levels in the Saudi government as an advisor to senior government leaders in the past. In fact, even here in Washington at the embassy. So he really knew how things worked. He was sort of a member of the establishment, really, while at the same time being a columnist and journalist. And he had initially supported Mohammed bin Salman, who is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who came on board as this young. He presented himself as this reformer, somebody who was ready to improve the economy, improve the social rules, for instance, allow women to drive and just be this reforming element in Saudi Arabia. But he became quite critical, Mr. Khashoggi, of the prince, because it was accompanied ultimately by quite a crackdown, an authoritarian crackdown on any sort of political dissent. And eventually, Mr. Khashoggi left the kingdom and came to Washington in self-imposed exile because he wanted to write freely. And I think that he would have been seen as a particular threat by the Saudi government, in particular the prince, because he knew how to explain this all to a Western audience. He was in Washington. People knew him here. So many people knew him here. And I think he had a fairly sympathetic audience.
And he went into the consulate in Istanbul. Why?
because he wanted to get married and he was going to be marrying a Turkish woman, and he had been previously married and he needed proof that that marriage had ended in divorce. So he went there on September 28th to get the appropriate documents, and he was told he should come back on October 2nd to get them. And when he went back the second time is when he disappeared.
And I had read one report that the staff of the consulate was suddenly given the day off on October 2nd. Have you heard that?
Well, these are reports that have been coming out in the media, sourced to Turkish, unnamed Turkish officials. So clearly the Turks are presenting a story that they feel they are not at this point ready to say officially. And that was one element. Yes, the story by and large is that that includes the local staff being given a holiday on that day in the consulate, but also that 15 Saudi officials arrived in Turkey on that day from two different planes and went to the consulate. They have been identified again by Turkish media with their pictures published as members of senior intelligence and security officials from Saudi Arabia. There was even a report in the Turkish newspapers that they had carried in a bone saw, and that that he was killed there. And then ultimately, since Mr. Khashoggi did not come out, there was a black van that went out from the consulate building to the residence. And it's said by these anonymous Turkish officials that that was how his body was carried out of the consulate.
All right. Barbara Platt-Usher from the BBC, thanks so much for bringing us up to date. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And joining us now, Eli Lopez is Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post. Welcome and thank you for joining us. I'm sure it's a very difficult week for you and your colleagues at The Post.
Well, thank you for having me and for choosing to highlight this.
And also joining us, John Alterman. He's Senior Vice President and Middle East Program Director for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. John Alterman, welcome to you as well.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
And Eli, just tell us, if you would, a little bit about this man and Jamal Khashoggi and how he was connected to the Post and how people there are feeling about this.
This has been incredibly hard, and we have been devastated from the very beginning, worried about his whereabouts and his well-being. Of course, now, you know, by learning more and more revelations, you know, we were fearing the worst, and now we're demanding answers. We want a clear path to, you know, having the facts come out, and also, you know, accountability and consequences for this. This is a very, very, very serious, monstrous crime that sends such a chilling message to journalists and critics and opposition figures of autocratic regimes all over the world. We are very deeply, deeply concerned.
What would you say, knowing probably as well as anybody, what his columns were about? What is it, not to justify it, of course, but what was it, you think, that really would make the Saudi government want to get rid of him?
Jamal occupied a very, very important and premier spot in journalism in the Middle East. He was a veteran journalist with decades of experience. He had been close to the Saudi government and had been part of the inner circle of the royal court for many years, but he also was the editor of a very important and progressive newspaper in Saudi Arabia. He had a column for 7 years. So he was somebody that also had, such a wide network of contacts all over the Western world and in Washington. He was a person that journalists from all over the world could go to for deep knowledge of Saudi Arabia, you know, a country that's very closed off, but he has such inside knowledge that he could provide, you know, a lot of answers. So he had been critical of the new sort of, you know, the crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. His wave of reforms, you know, were carried out with a mix of, you know, also crackdown on dissidents and activism. Jamal came from a place of, you know, he wanted to offer constructive criticism. He wanted to point out the things that needed reform, and he was supportive of some of these measures, but he also wasn't afraid to speak up when he saw injustice and when he saw his friends, intellectuals, activists, journalists being jailed. So he was a very, very high profile figure.
And what kind of help are you asking or demanding from the U.S. government, and to what extent are you getting it?
We want the U.S. government to, the Saudi Arabia being a key ally of the United States and very close to the current Trump White House, we want them to, to use all the pressure they can to find answers and to demand, accountability. We know that there's a very deep relationship. We know there are arms deals and all kinds of big business interests involved. We want the United States to show, with actions, that this is not something that it could be tolerated. The United States should have, principles enshrined in the Constitution reflected in foreign policy. And this is a country that respects freedom of the press and freedom of speech. And to have an ally behave in this way and not pay any consequences will be so hypocritical, and it will damage the U.S. standing in the world.
All right. Eli Lopez, a global opinions editor with The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us. Our thoughts are with you and your newsroom.
Thank you.
And this is just a half-hour segment, so let's open up the phone lines now. If you'd like to weigh in, the number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments or questions to forum@kqed.org or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. John Alterman, what is the relationship, or what was the relationship like between Turkey and Saudi Arabia?
It was increasingly tense. Saudis perceived Turkey to be aligned with Qatar in supporting the Muslim Brotherhood after the revolutions that swept the Arab world in 2011. And Turkey saw itself in some ways as the model for where a lot of these revolutions wanted to go. Saudi Arabia saw the idea of democratic revolution sweeping the region as deeply threatening, and relations have gotten worse. And in fact, some of the Saudi press is just ignoring this case, but some of the Saudi press is saying this is just Turkish Qatari propaganda to undermine change in Saudi Arabia. We're all on board with the change the Crown Prince is doing, and ignore all the stuff you're hearing.
And of course, Turkey's president has had his own. There's been plenty of critics of him also being increasingly autocratic and reducing democratic rights in the country.
Turkey has more journalists in jail than any country in the world right now.
Yeah. And so to what extent is this story being reported there?
I don't read Turkish, so I can't tell you how it's being reported, except when I sort through Google Translate, which gives me, I think, about 30% of what's going on. What is interesting is just how much is being leaked. But frankly, given the way some of my friends have shown up on the front page of Turkish newspapers as spies and everything else, I'm not sure how much of what's being leaked is accurate. Certainly when they leak the names and pictures and job occupations of the 15 Saudis who flew into Turkey, that looked like it was based on something pretty real, and nobody's refuted that. But I think there's still a possibility that there are things that aren't 100% accurate. And what we really don't know now is just how much we know and how much we don't know. I think there are people who know more than we do, but I think there's a lot that's unknown about this, starting with the idea of just how much does Turkey know about what happened inside the Saudi consulate?
You know, Saudi Arabia has had pretty close relationships with both Democratic and Republican presidents. It's considered to be a strong ally of the United States. What's different, do you think, about the nature of the relationship now under the Trump administration?
The Saudis became very concerned that with the United States rebalancing toward Asia and finding its own sources of oil, that the United States was going to lose interest in Saudi Arabia and lose interest in defending Saudi Arabia from regional competitors, including but not limited to Iran. And there was a sense of uncertainty as to whether the hostility they felt under the Obama administration was merely President Obama, or whether really this relationship, which had been foundational to the way the Saudis think about national security for 70 years, was going away. In many ways, the Crown Prince's greatest accomplishment since he's been in government has been rebuilding the U.S.-Saudi relationship, has been being seen in the White House, being seen with Jared Kushner, being seen as somebody who can come to the United States for several weeks at a time and meet with all the elites everywhere. And in many ways, relieving Saudis that, in fact, the U.S. relationship wasn't going away, and reaffirming Saudi Arabia's place in the world because the Crown Prince had been able to demonstrate close relations with the White House. In the event that this all seems to be going south and the Crown Prince, rather than building up the relationship, is dividing the relationship, that'll have profound consequences for the standing of the Crown Prince in the kingdom, because this relationship is universally believed to be important, and rebuilding it was one of his great accomplishments. Damaging it would be very damaging to his own prospects.
How does the fact that the President Trump and you mentioned Jared Kushner, I mean, they have, unlike past presidents and presidential families, they have direct financial ties and interests with the Saudi government, right?
I'm not confident I know enough to say they have direct ties with the Saudi government. Certainly there are people from the
Saudi
government.
Or at least Saudi investors, maybe.
Saudi investors, they've stayed in, Saudi government has paid for rooms in Trump hotels. You can decide that influences the president or not. I think, you know, in some ways, what I saw from the body language is they feel they understand each other. The sort of, you know, the Davos class seems almost threadbare compared to people who talk about buying yachts and paintings and all those things. And I think that there was a way in which they felt that they were among peers. And the way I saw it from outside, and I can't speak to the president's motivations or what he's really thinking, to my sense, so much more of it was a sense of finding an emotional connection and a personal connection rather than a financial interest. I could be wrong, but that's the way it looked to me.
Yeah. And of course, this bipartisan group of senators have sent a letter to Trump urging him to reconsider the arms deal with Saudi Arabia. And the president seems completely disinterested in that. And he said, look, if they don't buy those arms from us, they'll take their $110 billion somewhere else, like to China or Russia. Is that a mistake?
I mean, they can take it to China or Russia, and I think the Saudis would be reluctant to do that because the Saudis really want the United States to be there. There's no way that the Chinese or the Russians would do for Saudi Arabia and give for what the United States does and give Saudi Arabia that sense of security that it really feels it needs. I don't think they're going to run away. This could be a bumpy period. The fact is there are lots of ways that Congress can complicate the U.S.-Saudi relationship because we have such a broad and deep relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is about security issues, military issues, intelligence issues, commercial issues, financial issues, energy issues. I mean, we are all over the map with Saudi Arabia, and Congress has a way to put sticks in the spokes if it wants to. And I think, you know, a lot of this is about persuading the administration that it needs to be serious and engaged. The other thing to keep in mind is there are lots of constituencies in the United States that start off hostile to Saudi Arabia. People who say the Saudi government was directly behind 9/11. People who are angry about the way Saudi Arabia treats women. People who are angry about religious freedom in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you can go on and on and on. And in a way, the Khashoggi case gives a central rallying point to all of Saudi Arabia's critics, and the Saudis haven't even begun to refute the narrative that's coming out. So I think we're in for a bumpy several weeks. I can't tell where this will all end up, but it seems to me that the idea that you can just say, well, we're going to wait and see and we shouldn't do anything, when this all ends, we're going to be doing something.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Forum, and my guest for this half hour is John Alterman. He's Senior Vice President and Middle East Program Director for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about the disappearance and apparent murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And here's a listener comment. John, Emily asks, what's the connection, if any, between this incident and the release of American pastor Andrew Brunson, who was detained in Turkey? Just a coincidence?
I think it's largely a coincidence. There's something else going on, which is that Turkey is in a serious financial pickle, and the U.S. made that more serious when this dispute about Pastor Brunson increased over the summer. Whether the Turks are trying to do something to be more forward-leaning on the Khashoggi case and providing more information, it's possible. Whether the White House really wants to hear it, I mean, who do you get favor with by being cooperative with the United States? I'm not sure. My instinct is that the issue of the U.S.-Turkish bilateral relationship has its own momentum and its own direction, and the Khashoggi case is of interest to Congress. But I'm not sure the administration is really clamoring to be in the middle of this, and I'm not sure that the Turks get the kind of credit they want from the White House, which is what the Pastor Brunson issue is all about.
Well, one of the aspects of all this is that the United States has no ambassador in either Turkey or Saudi Arabia. What's the impact of that, the significance of that?
It does a couple of things. One is that just for protocol reasons, you have more junior people making requests and they're presumed not to have connections to the president and the White House. And so everything you ask for from foreign governments is harder to get. The other piece, which is in many ways equally important, is foreign governments don't really have an American to advocate for them inside the U.S. system. So when the governments have something to say and want to engage with American decision makers, there's nobody coherently making that case in the way the system is set up to work. So in some ways it disadvantages us, and to some ways it disadvantages the countries. I'll tell you one thing. When the White House does nominate an ambassador to Saudi Arabia, the hearings will be pretty interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's we're short on time, but there are reports that Uber, which is based here in San Francisco, and they've taken billions in Saudi investment cash. They're withdrawing from a conference in Riyadh, and Richard Branson is ending tourism talks with Saudi Arabia. So there could be some real financial implications for Saudi Arabia as a result of all this, right?
And for Silicon Valley, where Saudi Arabia has been really interested in investing. Look, we're in the first week of this. But certainly one of the ways this could play out is that all of the efforts to bridge Saudi Arabia and Silicon Valley and to bring Silicon Valley investments to Saudi Arabia and Saudi investments to Silicon Valley, that effort is likely to have a rough few months.
All right. John Alterman, Senior Vice President and Middle East Program Director for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much for joining us this half hour.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
You bet. And thanks also earlier in the hour to Eli Lopez from The Washington Post and Barbara Platt-Usher from the BBC. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with journalist David Downs about some cannabis tax measures that are on the ballot in some Bay Area cities and counties. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Mina Kim. Much more to talk about, a very different topic for the rest of the hour.